Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the April Telebrief. We may have some new folks on the line today, so if that's the case, welcome aboard. Plenty to talk about this morning, as always. So let me start with, I mentioned this was last year, the District of Columbia passed a statute, actually, which would ban non-compete agreements in most cases. And through a series of postponements, the latest one, which was just published, is that this law will not take effect until October 1st of this year. So those of you who have employees in the district and who have wondered about the applicability of this non-compete law know that it will take effect, but it won't take effect until October the 1st. Along those lines, I wanted to mention that in July of last year, 2021, President Biden issued an executive order asking the Treasury Department, in combination with the Department of Justice and the Department of Labor and the Federal Trade Commission, to come up with proposals regarding post-termination restrictions of employees, along with anti-competitive measures that some companies are engaged in. And the Treasury Department just recently sent out a report, the details of which I'm not going to go over this morning because they're detailed. But suffice it to say, there is a movement afoot, and I've mentioned this many, many times in past telebriefs. There is a movement afoot to limit the applicability and enforceability of post-termination restrictions. Whether this will take the form of a statute or a further executive order, I don't know. But I will mention this. Those of you out there who utilize post-termination restrictions in the form of either a strict non-compete, where you're actually attempting to prevent a departing employee from working for a competitor, or lesser rigid restrictions in the form of non-solicitation agreements where you attempt to prevent a departing employee from soliciting any customers of your company or soliciting any of your employees, you need to be aware of the fact that there is not only legislative proposals being seriously discussed at both local and national levels, but judicial reluctance to enforce some of these. And I would say take a good look at your post-termination restrictions if you have them. And so don't make them any broader than is necessary in order to protect your confidential information. And hopefully you'll define that confidential information with specificity that you're trying to protect. With regard to non-solicitation of customers, I usually advise clients now to restrict these non-solicitation provisions to those customers with whom the departed employee had contact during the last year or two of his or her employment, so that it is very specific. In other words, you're not trying to prevent that departed employee from contacting all customers of the company, but rather those customers with whom the departed employee had a relationship. Same thing with employees in so-called non-poaching agreements, where you're attempting to prevent the departed employee from poaching your employees. Try and limit those provisions to those employees with whom the departed employee actually worked or had supervisory responsibility, as opposed to sort of a blunderbuss approach where you're attempting to prevent the departed employee from calling or soliciting any employee, even if that departed employee had no contact with those employees during the time that he or she was employed. So from my perspective, it's time, if you have or are contemplating imposing these kinds of restrictions, to take a very rigid approach, make it specific in nature, and if you have questions about the enforceability or drafting these provisions, by all means, you should be talking to an experienced employment attorney who can advise you on how to draft and hopefully how to enforce those provisions. Let me turn the page and mention another legislative development so that, and this is on the federal level, on March the 3rd, just a month ago, President Biden signed into the law a statute called the Ending Forced Arbitration of Sexual Assault and Sexual Harassment Act of 2021. It's a long name, but essentially, this is the guts of the statute. It says, at the election of the person alleging conduct constituting a sexual harassment dispute or a sexual assault dispute, or the named representative of a class or in a collective action alleging such conduct, no pre-dispute arbitration agreement or pre-dispute joint action waiver shall be valid or enforceable with respect to a case which is filed under federal, tribal, or state law and relates to the sexual assault dispute or the sexual harassment dispute. In simple terms, what President Biden signed, and this was, again, a statute passed by both the House and Senate. So it will give an employee the option of whether or not to abide by an arbitration agreement where the nature of that dispute is either a sexual harassment complaint or a class-based complaint having to do with sexual harassment or sexual assault. So those of you out there who have these arbitration provisions with your employees are going to have to modify those provisions in accordance with this statute. And I know that I've spoken about this probably in the past year or two in telebriefs. You know, one alternative to arbitration agreements is a so-called jury trial waiver that would be signed either by a new onboarding employee or an incumbent employee, under the terms of which that employee would agree with the company that any dispute arising out of the employment or termination of employment would be heard by a judge as opposed to a jury. And you might ask, well, what is the benefit of that to the company? And frankly, based on my years of experience over many disputes, you're always better off as the employer with a bench trial as opposed to a jury trial for a lot of different reasons. First of all, the cost of a jury trial is much more extensive than in a bench trial. It just works out that way because of the processes and the procedures. Secondly, with a bench trial, you have a much better chance of receiving a defense verdict as opposed to a jury trial, and you have a much better chance of getting summary judgment, that is, getting the case disposed of even before it would go to a trial on the merits. And last, and this is really extremely important, you have a much better chance in a bench trial of it being a reasonable verdict if it's a plaintiff's verdict as opposed to a jury trial where so often an employer is faced with a runaway verdict. So in order to get these or implement jury trial waivers, they need to be worded in a specific way and they need to be conspicuously noted to the employee, and I can certainly give you some advice on that. But contemplate now that these arbitration agreements are coming under fire, think about whether or not you can at least decrease your legal and monetary exposure by implementing jury trial waivers along the way. Now, I wanted to mention a couple very recent cases which have practical imports for you in the HR world. So, very recently, on February the 7th, just a couple months ago. The Tenth Circuit published a case, an opinion, and the case was Lamm, L-A-M-M, versus Devaughn, D-E-V-A-U-G-H-N, James, LLC. In this case, you had an employee who had mental health conditions and who was manifesting attendance issues frequently, calling in without much notice, working half days. And this employee requested an accommodation to work half days under a theory that she had that she should get this accommodation under the ADA. And she was indicating that she was experiencing intense anxiety and therefore she needed to be accommodated. Well, over a period of time, the company kept track of her absences, and after this period of time of frequent absences, terminated her. She filed suit, and what happened was the Tenth Circuit dismissed the case. And they noted that under the ADA, of course, the employee has to be a qualified individual, meaning under the law that the employee has to be able to perform the essential functions of the job with or without a reasonable accommodation. And in this case, in evaluating the accommodation claim, the court indicated that it would apply a two-part analysis. First, whether the employee was able to perform the essential functions of the job, and if not, whether any reasonable accommodation would enable that employee to do so. The Tenth Circuit, in its opinion, found that because she was away from work excessively and often without warning, that the employee was not able to perform the essential functions of the job, and that regular and predictable job attendance should have been and was an essential job performance indicator, and that because she wasn't able to do that because of her sporadic absences, that she was neither a qualified individual or needed to be accommodated because the accommodation would not have enabled her to perform those essential functions of the job. Now, this is not a unique decision. Many other circuits, including the Fourth Circuit, the one that we find ourselves in, have indicated that in many cases, if not most, regular job attendance is an essential function of the job. And I say this because you may want to go back and look at your job descriptions and make sure that in many cases, regular job attendance should be listed as an essential job indicator. And if those job descriptions don't, you may want to think about modifying them, because one of the things that courts and administrative agencies look at is whether your job descriptions are clear that regular job attendance is an essential job function. Now, another case that I wanted to point out, and I think it's a significant case. This was a case decided by the Fifth Circuit, which is in the South, decided just on March the 24th of this year. And it came to the court upon a dismissal of a pro se complainant, meaning a complainant who was representing himself instead of through a law firm. So in this case, which is called Anthony Woods versus Latoya Cantrell, mayor of New Orleans and the city of New Orleans, it alleged that his prior employer, French Market Corporation, violated Title VII by discriminating against him on the basis of race and religion and by subjecting him to a hostile work environment. Now, in this case, it alleged that in the presence of other employees, Woods' supervisor, who happened to be a person of Hispanic descent, directly called him a, in quotes, lazy monkey N-word. What happened was the district court dismissed his complaint on the basis that a single utterance of a racial epithet despicable as it is, cannot support a hostile work environment. The case made its way up to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit indicated that we think that the district court erred in this one respect. They said it is true that this court, meaning the district courts in the Fifth Circuit, have indicated that a single instance of a racial epithet does not in itself support a claim of hostile work environment. However, they go on to say that we have further said, however, that under the totality of the circumstances test, a single incident of harassment, if sufficiently severe, can give rise to a viable Title VII claim. As they said, as other circuits have recognized, including this circuit, our circuit, the Fourth, in quotes, perhaps no single act can more quickly alter the conditions of employment and create an abusive working environment than the use of an unambiguously racial epithet such as the N-word by a supervisor in the presence of his subordinates. Furthermore, they quote, the N-word has been further described as, in quotes, a term that sums up all the bitter years of insult and struggle in America, a pure anathema to African Americans, and probably the most offensive word in English. And this happened to be a concurring opinion by Judge, now Justice Kavanaugh. I bring this to your attention for two reasons. One is the use of that epithet is still something that cannot be tolerated in the workplace. And in the presence of subordinates, as spoken by a supervisor, gives rise unambiguously to the creation of a hostile work environment. And I know coming out of the pandemic, I have spoken about the need to update your policies and procedures on workplace harassment and discrimination. And importantly, and according to the EEOC, militates in favor of periodic training and comprehensive training in discrimination and workplace harassment elimination and the things that need to be paid attention to by your managerial and supervisory staff. So a word to the wise, look at your policies and procedures, update them, and contemplate the use of regular training, probably by an outsider, to make sure that your managerial and supervisory staff is up to date on what needs to be done and what shouldn't be done in the workplace. One other case I wanted to mention has to do with a case called Anderson versus National Lending Corp., a March 2022 case for the Seventh Circuit. Very briefly, what happened was an employee with a history of performance deficiencies went on an FMLA leave. When she was on leave, the company did some auditing in her department and flagged a number of errors which she had committed, which caused the government agency that the company was doing business with to cite her employer. Her supervisor recommended her termination, and HR conducted an investigation into her performance, and she returned to work, and the investigation was completed 3 days later, and then she was terminated. She filed a lawsuit contending that the company had violated her FMLA rights to reinstatement and retaliated against her for taking FMLA leave. The Seventh Circuit, and this is not, again, a unique decision, cited that, in quotes, an employee is not entitled to return to her former position if she would have been fired regardless of whether she took the leave. I point this out because I know that I've dealt with several clients in several situations where even during an FMLA leave, which was approved by the company, begins to audit or comes into the presence of evidence, which in the absence of of an FMLA leave would have justified termination. And, you know, I cite that because I always tell clients that FMLA leave does not immunize the employee who's on that leave from disciplinary action or even layoff if the disciplinary action or layoff would have been done even in the absence of the FMLA leave. The last thing that I want to mention this morning is some of you may have read about the successful organizing attempt at an Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, which really I think is sort of a landmark in labor relations and the state of unionization today. I think coming out of COVID and given the fact that there's a labor shortage in many industries, including maybe some of your own, you need to be aware of the fact that despite the fact that the overall percentage of unionization in the private workforce is still around 6%, so that's low, that certainly does not immunize you as a company from organizing attempts. And look, if Amazon and Starbucks, companies who have large resources to fight unionization, and in this case, Amazon was reputed to have spent millions in its anti-organizing attempts, and the union that organized Amazon was an independent union. It wasn't even a union affiliated with the AFL-CIO. If it can happen to Amazon, if it can happen to Starbucks, it can happen to you. And I know I've preached to the choir many times in the last several telebriefs about the need to do union vulnerability audits. And those are audits which can be done with a minimum sort of training and expense. I mean, I do them on a regular basis for clients, but union audits, vulnerability audits, can at least make your supervisory and management staff aware of things that need to be done in order to protect or ameliorate the risk of unionization in your company. Update your policies, particularly on no solicitation and no distribution, and make sure that managers and supervisors have their ears and eyes to the ground as to whether or not there are any present threats of unionization in your workforce. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Lauren and or Aaron, can you take this off of mute? Okay, as I always do, I'm happy to answer any questions based on, you know, what I've covered. Anybody out there have any questions, comments?
Hi, this is Cherie King from Maryland Department of Transportation. I just need the cite for that 10th Circuit case. I think it was Lynn versus, I didn't get the last.
Yeah, I can get that to you. I don't have the cite right before me. If you can send me an email, I'll send you the cite, if that's okay.
Okay, sure. All right, thank you.
All right, sure. Any other questions, comments?
Hi, Howard. This is Leslie. So, going back to the...
I can't hear you too well. I'm getting a little echo. I'm sorry.
That's okay, Howard. It's Darlene with Fuse.
Hi.
So the real quick question I had, rolling back to the original, you know, non-compete agreements, for a person in a managerial position, can we limit their, quote-unquote, poaching of employees to a specific time frame?
Sure.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And I, as I said, Darlene, I think the provisions that are most enforceable are those which are specific in nature and built around the experience of the particular person that you're seeking to impose restrictions on.
Okay. Yeah, that was how I heard it, but I just wanted to make sure I was hearing it right.
You heard it right. You got good ears.
Great. Thank you, Howard.
Anybody else? Okay, well, if not, I hope everybody has a good rest of the day, and we will see each other, at least virtually, a little in our telebrief in the first Wednesday in May. So thanks, everybody, for your participation. Have a good one.